super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Ladies and gentlemen, the man who thought Sarah Palin's new book was a paint-by-numbers, 42nd Street Pete!
Hey, we're back. This is a live show this week. I apologize for last week. There was some personal issues that came up, mainly my computer crashing and the Norton antivirus protection that I paid for, doing a 360 instead of giving me 360 degrees worth of protection. So that sucks. And then trying to buy a computer in the state of New Jersey when they have no stock whatsoever except for laptops. And the only thing I want to sit on my lap is some hobby. So fuck that. So anyway, yeah, that's what happened last week, and I apologize for that, but we got a good guest this week, Keith Crocker, director of Night of the Bloody Ape, and Blitzkrieg Escape from Stalag 69, and we also were part of that Summer of Sleaze back in the Pioneer Theater that was, you know, managed by Lee Peterson, who pretty much let us do whatever we wanted down there, and yeah, it was a good thing, but, you know, before we get into that, unfortunately, some bad news is two porn stars died during this week. Actually, New Year's Eve, Erica Boyer was killed in a car accident in Florida. She was 53 years old. Erica did a lot of stuff in the 80s and did some great girl stuff with Nina Hartley, Barbara Dare, and other stuff. And she, you know, unfortunately, that's what happened to her. And Juliet Anderson, a.k.a. Aunt Peg, was found dead in her apartment. There's nothing more on that, but they haven't ruled out foul play because some weird stuff was going on. But anyway, Aunt Peg has passed away also. So the long-awaited, highly anticipated Extreme Sleaze Showcase 2, the Blackjack Book Collection, is finally available. Got my copy last week to check it out, and I'm fucking proud of this one. This is one sick puppy. You won't want to miss it. It's 23 of the most depraved loops. This shit you could actually buy at the Blackjack Book Center on 42nd Street. And it's all the stuff that ran into in the peeps and they were selling. It is like real fucking nasty, and I actually forgot how nasty it was till I just relived it. And all I can say is, it's fucking great stuff. And I'm actually working on Extreme Sleaze Showcase Part 3, the Peepland Collection, as we bullshit here. But anyway, you hooked up with at least technical difficulty. We're having some kind of technical difficulty.
We're good, man. We are good.
We're good. You hit something with a fucking hammer, and this is what happened with this.
We're rocking.
I can hear you as I'm talking. I hear you tapping on shit in the back. You know, it's fuck.
We're good now, man. We're good. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So
about that time to get Keith on too.
Yeah, I think so. Why don't we give Keith a shout and get him on?
We'll go to a break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. Hopefully.
Jackalope 105 FM.
For those of you who want to interact with the show, join the three-wing circus, wind up at the ninth level of hell. Just go to www.jackalope105fm.com and click on chat, and then you'll be in the chat room. Or you might think you're in the chat room. You might be in my room, the room I broadcast out of, the room that's chained up and padded. So make your choice as well, my friends. You never know where you're going to end up here.
You think Pinhead's hard. Man,
you just thank God for weed because that little dwarf is still kicking my colon out.
No dwarf, you know? Man. No dwarf.
Jackalope 105 FM.
For those of you who want to interact with the show, join the three-wing circus. Wind up at the ninth level of hell. Just go to www.jackalope105fm.com and click on chat, and then you'll be in the chat room. Or you might think you're in the chat room. You might be in my room, the room I broadcast out of, the room that's chained up and padded. So make your choice as well, my friends. You never know where you're going to end up here.
You think Pinhead's hard. Man.
You just thank God for weed because that little dwarf is still kicking my colon out.
No dwarf, you know? Man. No dwarf.
How about a big bag of Skittles? Lemon, lime, grape, watermelon. Oh.
Jackalope 105 FM.
And we're we're back with 42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse and the man of the hour, the man with the power of the grindhouse in his soul, 42nd Street Pete.
We're back, and it's my pleasure to welcome Keith Crocker to the show. Keith, how you doing?
I am doing fine. How are you doing tonight, Pete?
Oh, I'm great. I'm rocking and rolling here. I got my glass of wine. I got my joy, and I'm happy.
That's the way to do it, man. Yeah. That's the way to do it. No other way.
Yeah, really. What else is there to do in life? There's only so few pleasures I can enjoy lately. Those are the last two, you know?
Exactly, exactly. You know, at least you know you're in a safe place, you know, doing your thing and staying out of harm's way.
Yeah, definitely.
You know? That's for sure.
Yeah, we go back quite a bit. I was, you know, just thinking the other day about how the whole Abbey thing came up and stuff back in the chiller days when it was nice to go there and stuff.
Yes. It feels like a long time. Yes, it's been nice to go there. But yeah, we do go back a bit. There's no doubt about that. You know, we saw the rise of the fandom here. You know, the beginning of the conventions, or the resurgence of the conventions, I think might be the best word, considering there were conventions in the mid-70s and whatnot. You know, there's always been conventions, but I mean, we saw it all coming together here. You know, so it was quite an interesting history. You know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then there was a whole thing with, you had put this film out, and, you know, we were talking, and I said, well, let me check it out. I'll write a review. And I didn't know that everybody was really shitting on it for some reason, because I thought it was good. You know, and I wrote it for Uncut, which is, you know, I don't know what Uncut's doing right now. They were worldwide at one point. I don't know if they were still publishing or not, but it was in there, and I honestly didn't know that people were really crapping all over that film, and I don't know why.
Well, you know what had happened? I had put Abbey out. I started Cinefear Video in 1992, and the first things that we were selling were 16mm transfers, and these were films from my, you know, private collection. And Abbey was one of those titles, and we had been offering it, and we were the first, you know, obviously the first offerers. I was the only one with a 16mm print at that point. And, you know, smart enough to transfer it and get it out there. People really wanted it, and then we ended up putting it onto DVD. But what I hadn't realized was at the time that a kind of a mania developed over what should be and what shouldn't be put on DVD. In other words, the concept of people, how people viewed DVD and how people viewed video had changed, and DVD to them meant that the film had to come from the original archival elements, you know, whether it was negative or whatever, everything had to be done perfectly. And then at the earliest DVDs, that wasn't the case. People were kind of doing what they had done on video, kind of just grabbed whatever print they had and put it on there. So I was being attacked by a bunch of psychotic nerds more than anything, these, what I call these perfectionist types, these, you know, these lunatics that have to have basically, you know, grindhouse cinema, if we can use the word, looking perfect. Which you never looked perfect when you saw it in the theater.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, half the joy was the beat up look to it. Half the joy was that. And I think what happened, but you know, I'll tell you this, Pete. It was a couple of vocal lunatics who are never pleased with anything. The bulk of the people who picked up the DVD were quite happy with it. And I, you know, I received as many compliments as I did criticism. And I think, like I said, I think down the line, as people put it together and they said, well, gee, you know, this never ended up coming out legally and probably never will, they end up appreciating those of us, you know, kind of went out of our way to save these films and bring them out and let people see them. So, I have no regrets about Abbey. I'm very proud of Abbey. No problem at all whatsoever.
No, it was a good film. And, you know, honestly, you know, the print itself was dark because a lot of Gridler's stuff was dark for some reason. He just, well, you know, did.
I think there's no question about that. And I think it also goes back to the fact that, you know, you're talking about a 16mm print, you know, and most 16mm prints usually were made for television showing. And I think that, you know, again, it becomes a reduction, and a lot of times it's not nearly as good as, obviously not nearly as good as a 35mm print. But again, can a beggar be a chooser? Is it better to be able to see the film in some sort of form than not see it at all? And I'm from the generation, see, way before the video watchdog mindset set in. You know, I'm way before that. It was like we were just so appreciative when video first came out, to be able to see these movies and not have to wait for a re-release or a retrospective theater. And it was very exciting, you know, between videotape and cablevision. If you were a film lover, to get to see these movies, it was remarkable. It was a remarkable experience. So, I was never. It wasn't for me to demand or request perfection. I was just so happy to be able to see these films that I never thought I would be able to see in an uncut version because they were cut heavily on television. So, you know, whatever it was, I was just very appreciative. So, you know, I'm not a demander. I never was. I mean, I appreciate, as a filmmaker, I appreciate people taking their time and doing the best job they can to get their films to look good on, you know, a media like DVD. I do, certainly, as a filmmaker, I appreciate it. But as a person who appreciates movies and not wanting them to be lost or, you know, not be able to get your hands on them, I'll take them and however we can get them. Yeah, you know, I mean, that was my view. That's still my view. You know?
I got an interject. Yeah.
I remember we paid big money for a 10th generation print or something just to have the damn thing.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
It's true.
I think that was a joy, though, didn't it? Excited at the time. I mean, to me, it was like a drug. I mean, it was really serious. It was like passing around drugs. To find these movies or to go and, you know, get even a boot of something or whatever it was so exciting. It was so thrilling. And it was, it united us all in fandom. And I think that was what brought us together. And Pete, you recall, you've talked about this before. You know, the face of fandom has degraded. It's not what it used to be, you know. And a lot of this has to do with the internet and the being anonymous on the internet. And people, you know, they get on there, they'll get into a forum, or they'll go on one of these chat sites, and they'll get on there and they tear apart. All they do is spend their time tearing apart. It's more complaint, it's more aggravation than it is compliment. And again, I think this is, you know, probably caused by the internet and the fact that these people don't really see each other or know each other. It's the fact that they're anonymous allows them to act out, because if they acted out in front of sight, risk getting their face punched in or their jaw ripped off. I think half the people, or anyone, you know, who acts out like that really would watch doing it in person, because they could get hurt. They really could.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, the internet protects them. So they're like, oh, I can say whatever the hell I want. No, you really can't, or you really shouldn't. I'm not talking about suppressing things. I'm just saying, you know, if it's non-constructive, if it's just for the sake of being nasty, it's pointless. And that's what I feel the bulk of these chat sites or these sites that are supposed to report news. I think that they're predominantly bad things. I stay away from them. I have no interest in being involved. Because basically, if you bring yourself out there, you're dealing with a lot of jackasses. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it wears you down. Who's got the time for that, you know?
Well, I had that whole thing going on with the fucking torrent site, and as far as I know, it's the longest thread in the history of the Maniacs thing, because I wasn't backing down. I mean, I'm getting ripped off, and I think at one point some of your stuff was up there, too.
Yeah, you know, what are we referring to, Pete?
That Cinemageddon torrent site where they're just, you know, they stream the shit for nothing. Even, you know, you put a release out and 2 days later it's up there for free, you know, that type of shit.
No, I know what you're talking about. I mean, with these download things, I think what the problem was in the case of Cinemageddon, and I have two views on it. I think one of the problems was initially they went against their own rules. I know when they first came up, they had made, you know, promises, you know, vocalized promises to the fact that they were going to avoid putting up anything that was a new release, whether it was an indie release or whatever, and especially if it had some sort of theatrical release. I think they had a time limit of a year or so. And what they did was they bent their own rules. I know that when Blitzkrieg went up there, Rob had approached them in a very positive manner, and they did move Blitzkrieg. It might have had something to do with the way Rob approached them. I think it's like anything, you know, if you go in the right way, you know, you'll pretty much be treated the right way. The one side of the Cinemageddon, it's like if something is 35 years old or 30 years old or 40 years old, some of the things have never been released. I have less of a problem with them putting it up there. I think, especially if no one else has put it out, that then you're providing some sort of a service. I know some of the fans there have even subtitled some of the foreign films because they have a lot of foreign fans that are up there. And I think that in a way can be a service. I think the only time you really desecrate the service is when you go against your own rule. And if something has just come out and you're saying don't release it for a while, well, definitely don't do that. Give it the time. Stay within your rules. Because that's going to cause a lot of bad blood.
Well, that's what happened, because they started telling, like, we sent them a nice letter asking them, please removed, and we got to fuck you back. The guy, Robin Burgee up in Canada with Cinema Sewer, they put a bunch of something it had to do with, and they were just getting nasty with people, and it's like, there is legal action pending. I can tell you that. I'm not going to say anything more, but there is legal action pending on this thing. We're not laying down in front of it and let it steamroll us.
I understand that. You know, I can understand what's going on with that. You know, I haven't been following it a hell of a lot, but I can understand, you know, what you're saying. You know, like I said, certain things have to be respected, and there's no doubt about that, and especially, like I said, if they had put rules in place, they have to follow their own rules. You really can't go backtracking on what you've set up. I think that that's what's vitally important, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's definitely what's vitally important.
Well, Pete, I got to interject something here, man. One of the things I wanted to say about earlier in the conversation, I totally agree with the nitpicky thing going on. I don't consider those guys nerds, though, because I'm a nerd, and I used to get stuff from Gore Gazette, and I couldn't even see the picture. It looked like a watercolor painting someone spilled a Coke on, you know? But us nerds, we love the movies. I think it's more of a, it's like people who become like too, like the artsy crowd, the people who are too, it's almost like film discussion and film opinion in school. It becomes too critical of everything. It's almost at that point like you're in a classroom, like you're taking everything and putting it under a microscope, and that, to me, you're kind of losing the essence of a fun drive-in movie.
Oh, I agree with you, Todd. I mean, the way I view it, there's no question about it. When I said nerds, you know, I mean, I'm talking about they're a different form of nerds. I think they're more, you know what I think it is, Todd? I think there are film fans, and I think there are film fanatics. I think there are people who are you know, slightly out of touch with reality.
And they're douchebags. Those are the ones that cause the problems.
Yeah, they demand, you know what it is? They demand so much. And they don't at all put any common sense into what it takes to be able to get something out on DVD. I mean, this is what Pete's bringing up too with the free downloads. It hurts. Free downloads do hurt independent filmmakers, because independent filmmakers need that money coming in so they can make more films. A lot of people are under the assumption, well, if you can make a film, you're rich, or you've got money. And no, that's not the case at all. I can only get away with making films because I can make them on pennies. It's the only way. I'm not, you know, it's not like I'm hiding some kind of secret stash here. And so that's angering. It does anger me. But you know what's happened, too? The way we view movies and the way we value movies has been degraded by the very industry. The whole concept of the download, or the ability to watch a movie on your cell phone, or
God, who wants to? That's horrible.
It's hard, because when I was growing up, Todd, it was the movie theater. That was an event.
Same here.
If we went to a drive-in or we went to a movie theater, it was an event.
I agree.
Enjoyed it. I mean, you felt the excitement. To me, you know, movie theaters bring out something. It's a whole special feeling. When you degrade it to, well, here's a free download, or you know, especially of something new, I'm talking more in that favor. It's not something that, you know, that's a problem, because you've degraded it. You don't put any value on it at all. Here, it's for you. Here, you can tell by the way people treat DVDs. My wife is a librarian. If you take a DVD out of a library, it's not a rentable media, because these people treat them like coasters. Skidding them across the floor. They never, the ones you get out of the library, they barely play. They get stuck a lot and whatnot because some jackass has been tossing them around the room or treating them like basically like shit. So you get them all scratched up and stuff, and the laser can't read it. And this is how we're getting to the point where it's become too disposable. Media is too disposable.
Disposable media.
It's funny you say that, because at Hollywood Video, you know, they always sell their previously viewed stuff, and I happen to pick up a previously viewed disc there, you know, some obscure B-horror movie. I get it home, I open it up, it was literally brown. It looked like someone had, like, put chocolate all over this thing, so I went back up there, and I showed it to the mayor, and I said, someone wiped their ass with my DVD.
Yeah.
And he should have seen his face.
Of course they did. It's just really unfortunate, and what happens is this industry, in its greed, will kill itself. I mean, it'll get reborn again. You know, I always believe things go in cycles. I think in the long run, things do come back. They don't come back the same exact way. They can't. Time marches on. But I think, you know, I think what's going to happen is things are going to have to bottom out. And I think that, you know, the industry sort of destroyed itself. It's sort of cutting its own throat. You know, I was part of the Projectionist Union here on Long Island for a brief period of time, and spoke with a projectionist friend the other day, and he was telling me now how they're, you know, planning on getting rid of the projectors and putting in digital, projection. And it's just, it's crazy. It really is just crazy. And their thought in doing it is that they're going to save money then on the projectionist. They don't have to per se ever Yeah, but you need someone there to maintain the machine. You need someone there in case something breaks. You don't really save. It's a very expensive machine. I think it's like about $500,000. It's crazy what they're thinking to do in order to save money. You know, causing damage and losing jobs. It's crazy. You know, it's going to bottom out.
Well, yeah.
Hopefully it'll come back fresh. You know,
they're talking about also the cost of shipping films is like the reason why we're paying so much at the box office is because the shipping of the films has gone up so high. And they're talking about, you know, all those reels that they're trying to break it down. And if they do it digitally, they could send it either over a network or they could send it on discs, and it would be.
That's going to suck. It's going to be like watching a big screen TV in the outdoors.
Yeah. You see, that's just it. What's the point? The point of going to the movies was that you got to see something projected that you couldn't do in your own house. I mean, yes, I know some people have set up their own little theater and stuff, but I mean, really, the whole experience was the grandeur of being in the theater and the projection and the whole thing. With that gone, there's going to be problems. It's definitely going to be major problems. The whole excitement.
And on that note, you and Robin Lee basically brought that back for a whole summer.
You know, I appreciate you bringing that up. We did, as you know, Pete, because you were a part of it, we did the Summer of Sleaze, and we did some 35mm film projection, some prints that were in my collection. We showed my film when it was, I got to premiere my film over at the Pioneer Theater, and it played for a week over there, which, you know.
Which great,
definitely. And having a week-long theatrical showing in New York City is a... It's an honor. It's an honor that most people, especially people in the digital age now, the digital age filmmakers, don't have a chance to get that. And it was, you know, to me, it was the most thrilling thing that could happen. When we did that Summer of Sleaze, it was fantastic. It's unfortunate, like I said, that the theater was already on its way out, all sorts of problems and headaches connected with it, because there was a revival going on. And then Rob, with his beautiful art of advertising and really knowing how to generate interest, was bringing a lot of people in there. We had the place packed, even on the premiere of my film, which was fascinating to me, absolutely fascinating to me. So, we really had something going there, and the intention was to bring back the good time. And as I said to you, Pete, we spoke about a week ago, and one of the things that me and you bantered around was just how interesting and how kind the people were at those showings, because... They were, and I said it was because they were in a theater where they didn't have to rush in, rush out. They could stand in that lobby and talk. They could, you know, become a part of the whole feeling there. It was very family-like. And you don't get that anymore. I mean, it's a lost thing. You know?
And you know, the best parts was like when you ran Zombie in 35, and like people popped the same way they did 25 years ago.
It was remarkable.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah, no, you're right about that, and it was remarkable because Zombie really had, the feelings was real, because I had saw it when it first came out, and it was like, you know, it really recreated that, and I had been working on that for years, you know, back in the mid-90s, me and my ex-partner of the Exploitation Journal had actually tried doing some horror shows here at a theater on Long Island, because I was involved in the projection and I was involved in managing the theater. And we did some shows, and at that point, it was harder to get people to come into the theater. It was a very strange sort of thing. I don't know, maybe it was a Long Island thing, but it was to get people to come out. We had one or two really good shows, and then one time we did midnight shows that went over like a lead balloon. And, you know, it was sort of like the whole midnight culture was dead, and that was really a shame because it used to be thriving. And, you know, we kind of like washed our hands of it and didn't do it again. But, you know, when I did these shows with Rob this past summer, the result was so surprising. I mean, the fact that we had to turn people away.
Oh, that yeah, that was insane, them, yeah.
That was insane. Pete, it had been years since we saw something like that, you know? Amazing. It was really an amazing experience, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that basically, you know, the theater, you know, held 99 seats, and Phil was letting, another 20 in or something like that?
No question. No question. Yeah. He said to those people, he said, you can't necessarily sit. You have to sit to the side or you have to stand in the back. And that's what we had. We had people sitting to the side and we had people standing in the back. It was phenomenal. Really, really very exciting. I mean, really, really, really very exciting. You know, it was really great. And it was great because, you know, one of the good things about it was that we had, Lee Peterson there. And he was managing the theater at the time. And Lee was very open to doing things. I think... You know, the fact that Lee didn't have any kind of politics or he didn't have any kind of thing that was going to prejudice him against anybody doing something, he was open to opening the place up and doing things. And I think that's how we did. That's how it came about. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Without him, it would have never happened.
No, it wouldn't have happened. And the guy who was managing the theater, referred to him was a jackass, because I dealt with that guy a couple of times. I had rented them some prints and stuff, and they were, you know, he was a jackass. He really didn't know what he was doing, whereas Lee did have know what he was doing, and he also allowed us to have our hands in the running of it, and that's how everything went smooth. It was just a smart move, you know?
Oh, yeah. And just the whole diversity of what we did down there. I mean, we had that the Fang and Claw night.
Then we had Claw night was fascinating. We had the 42nd Street porno night where we were using the 16mm adult things that I had, and we had you come and talk and Jamie Gillis. I mean, that was exciting. The energy in the room was really, really exciting, you know?
Yeah, and we brought porn back to Manhattan after 25 years on the big screen.
Amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it was really, it's really something amazing, something to be really proud of, you know? We succeeded in doing what we wanted to do, you know? Like I said, it's unfortunate the theater was already, you know, it was past saving. Let's just leave it that way. Yeah. But at least we brought it up on up note, you know? At least we did the right thing and we made things good for them right up to the end. So that was nice, you know?
Yeah, we went out with a bang on Halloween night with Night of the Living Dead at midnight. And again, you know, how old is that film? 40 years now, and people were still reacting at the same points they did 40 years ago.
Unbelievable. I know. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. And, you know, that type of affection for a movie. And the fact that these people have seen it so many times, but they knew the importance of coming and watching it on a big screen. Yeah, it was just nice to see that happen. It was just really, really a great, you know, like I said, it was a good feeling every time I was over there. It was really nice, you know?
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the two premieres of Blitzkrieg, which they were almost standing room only, too.
And, you know, that was, like I said, that was amazing to me. I didn't necessarily expect that to happen. And for me, you know, it was my first film again after 10 years. And to be able to have that, you know, shown theatrically and to have it booked and to have people coming and see it and, you know, get feedback. And I think it worked, and it works especially as a group effort, to have people in that theater getting off on it as a group. That's what did it, because they were talking back to the screen, they were getting excited. And that, you know, then you know what you did worked. That's how you really know. A lot of that does not translate as well in a private viewing experience. You know, I think, you know, anyone who missed it, didn't get a chance to see it in that type of theatrical environment, didn't realize how good the reaction was. We do have a clip from, I mean, there's an extra on the DVD of the night we did that, and the, you know, the excitement and the general reaction of the crowd. I think that's what makes it so good. Rob's insisting on putting it on there was basically just to let people know that a theatrical environment and just really helps, you know, when it comes to watching.
Yeah.
You know?
And it did wind up getting into quite a few film festivals, too. I know
it,
that.
Well, it did. It absolutely did, and it's going to be shown again in the South African Film Festival, I believe, coming up in March. Same film festival that a couple back in October, it showed Bloody Eight. So, you know, it's the fact that it's getting out there into the festivals and that we've been invited out with it is terrific. The fact that it continues to sell when most DVDs, you know, would basically die after a three-month period, the fact that we're still moving it and we've printed it many times, it does so much. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel like I was kind of on the right track and you know, hoping to be able to give people something that they kind of wanted to see or would be interested in seeing. You know, I mean, you know, you just try to fish around. There's so much crap out there, Pete. We know this.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, there's a curse kind of in a way with the digital video age and the high def age. You know, it's great that people get their hands on equipment and make films. Now, I'm a film teacher. I've taught adult education film courses at a local college. And at one time in my life, I used to say, everybody should be making movies. Everybody can make movies. Now I have to take that back. No. Pete, I am serious, man.
You know, I've seen some of this stuff. I mean, they give it to me to look at. I'm like, man, you know.
You know, they don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. And the reason why they don't have a clue is because, if you were forced to do that stuff on film, and there was going to be cost, any kind of cost, it really kind of separated the men from the boys. It really did. Because what's happening now, it's all instant gratification stuff. And for me, I started on film. I was trained on film. I used to shoot Super 8 stuff myself as a kid. Then, you know, in college, I was doing 16mm. And that was where my training ground was. Bloody Ape was shot on film. It was sound Super 8mm film, but it was film. And that was because at the time, I hated the look of video so much that I was not going to shoot video. We had tested video footage, and it just looked god-awful. It looked, you know, it was very flat at the time. Video looked like soap opera. You know, basically, it was a very flat image. Couldn't do anything with it. The only time that I've had to go back on my word is basically with the digital video, but But if you light it and you shoot it like you're shooting film, you're able to a degree, recreate the look of film, to a degree, because there's grain in digital video. You can simulate, basically, grain. You can play around more with light. And that actually gives you the opportunity to make things that at least somewhat resemble film. And if you, especially if you've shot film in the past, you kind of know what to do with the lighting and where to, you know, how to set the camera up. A lot of these guys, the newer people that are doing stuff, they're doing a lot of it, and their big excitement is getting it on the computer and editing it. That's where their strengths and their skills lie. I've seen some beautiful stuff, but it's empty. I've seen some good-looking stuff, but it's so friggin' empty. There's no soul. And there's also the other problem, Pete, is that the filmmakers want to go for cult, like as if it's something you can actually create. You can't.
Cult yeah, it has to happen.
It's an accident, Pete. It has to happen. In other words, in order for it to happen, the filmmaker doesn't even know it's going to happen. If you're aiming for cult, well, then you're completely destroyed. You've defiled the concept. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the same thing as these people saying, oh, I'm making something for the grindhouse. These are the same people who, if truth be told, had to really sit in a real grindhouse, and I'm talking a 24-hour grinder, would not enjoy it, because it would be a very seedy place, a very uncomfortable place. They would not enjoy the experience. These are the people, they can talk about it like it's so great, they never really lived it. So the
the whole thing is, you and I, having lived it and gone through it, pretty much know what that audience wants.
That's what it really comes down to, you know. And if you really, you know, like I said, if you really know what the hell it was about, these guys, they want to recreate something that, like I said, I don't know if they would have totally enjoyed. People are very comfortable these days, Pete. The reason why you don't ever get a real, per se, revolution, or people really don't stand up against it, is because they're very comfortable. Everybody's kind of comfortable in their own little worlds. They're all bought off. They got computers. You got poor people with computers, Pete. You got fat, poor people with computers. What country has... What real country in absolute poverty has fat, poor people with computers?
I can't afford to eat, but I got a Mac, you know. Ain't a Big Mac, it's a Mac and screen and shit, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things you guys have to also talk about here is the fact that so many people today are emulating the people coming out of Hollywood, and like that, the movie Gamers and things like that. These filmmakers hire, or these studios hire filmmakers that aren't really filmmakers. They're commercial directors, or they've made some music videos, but there's a far cry. And I know I had to learn this the hard way, because I didn't have anyone to teach me. You know, they don't teach you about director's lines. They don't teach you about composition of shots. They don't teach you about any of that. So then they get up there and they think style is shaking a camera like there's no tomorrow. Hello, Rob Zombie. They shake it and shake it and shake it until your eyes are popping out, and they act like...
I fucking hate that shit.
That's,
you know,
so
I was watching something the other night, and it's like, you know, I really get to the point where I can't wear and stuff, and I got to dip into the archives, because it's much better made.
It's true.
I am just so thrilled that you said that, Todd, because what you're bringing up is exactly what's been bothering me. The films are not being made by filmmakers. They're being made by guys who do commercials, like you said, music video. And they're like you said, their view of style is really askew. It's not really what style is or what style was. On top of that, the concept of style is it's an obnoxious word. I think part of the reason why I love how crude The Bloody Ape is, how insulting it is in so many ways. And I didn't go out of my way. A lot of people, he went out of his way to make that way. No, I didn't. I made it as an exact replication of anyone who didn't have a budget. That's how it came out. It's like, if you don't have all the things that Hollywood gives you, or they work out, you know, you're forced to make a no-budget film. People are like, oh, you made that on purpose. I didn't make anything. I don't go in there motivated.
Yeah, but the Bloody Ape was still shot. I mean, you still put a camera where it needs to be. You still knew how to, because you'd watched so many movies. See, that's what I tell people. They're like, what do you tell us? What should we do? I say, go get a book called Film Directing Shot by Shot, which is an amazing book, blue cover.
Right.
I say, go get that, and then watch movies. And I tell a lot of people, take your little camcorder and take your friends and shoot the scenes, even if you don't have the costumes or the props, or even if you're not in the right location, shoot the scenes with the people in the same position. That way you learn where they need to be. You learn where the positioning is. And Bloody Ape, you know, that movie kicks ass, because it's like raw, it's in your face, and it is what it is. It's like a young film, but the cool thing about it is it's got that same energy that early Sam Raimi had, you know, that early stuff.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that, Todd. Thank you very much. I made it with the intention of... I make my work with two intentions. I want, number one, I really do want to entertain people. I want people to enjoy themselves. I really want them to get a kick out of it. But more, you know, sometimes you also want to get some of your ideas across, some of what you were thinking, and I think that that's where the soul of the film comes in. If you've got, and I'm not talking about beating people over the head with a pretentious message like Hollywood does with a lot of their left-wing messages and a lot of their nonsense, and they don't even believe half of what they're saying. They're telling you what they want you to do, but they don't behave themselves that way. They're not in the same situation as the common person, so I love the way they preach and they push, but I'm talking about if you make it a film with an authentic message, something from the heart, and I think that's where a film's soul comes in. And you are right, the independent filmmakers now, they're really imitating Hollywood. They're not going to imitate me. They're not going to imitate you. They're not going to imitate something, because their admiration, whether they admit it or not, is with Hollywood. They're so enjoying this video game approach to filmmaking. They're so enjoying this type of crap that they have to emulate it, and that they're emulating the wrong people. It's what it is an inbreeding, Todd. What's happening is inbreeding that's going to produce a very, very deformed child. I mean, that's what it is, and it continues to happen, you know?
We're in the Arkansas of filmmaking.
I think I'm watching it. It's called Inglourious Bastards.
Listen to you. At least the guy knew where to put a camera. Give him a break. At least he didn't shake it every time. Every time someone started to do some action, he didn't shake it, so you couldn't even tell who's fighting.
Oh, I can understand that, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, filmmaking has become a real difficult thing. I don't even consider it filmmaking anymore. It's as disposable as the media. It really is. And you know what's sad, though, with the Hollywood stuff? It's really a gross indulgence and a real loss of money. Because that stuff is very, very expensive. And, you don't see all that money up on the screen. A lot of that money is going to the pampering of the actors. It's going to the moving. The people don't realize all the machinery that moves. Because my brother-in-law's brother actually drives for drives a truck for the trailers. He drives the trailers in. Also, that alone, the expense there, that's a big piece of the budget. So those money, you hear all this millions and trillions of dollars, and a lot of it doesn't even reach the screen. It's in pampering the actors, feeding the actors, catering, rubbing their little feet. What the fuck is going on? It's crazy. It's not real art. It's really just more of a commerce thing. It's just, we'll turn it over a dollar. That's really more what it is,
I know you had a huge catering bill on Blitzkrieg. I remember that.
Oh, what it was huge. It was really, really huge. Those Dunkin' Donuts are getting expensive.
I'm telling you,
They're out of control with those caramel lattes and stuff. Oh,
hey, I got pizza on Blood Wings, and we ain't even done shooting yet. I can't wait to see the second course.
It's amazing. No, it's funny. No, it's funny, but like I say, for someone like me or Todd and stuff, you learn to do things on a dime or a penny, or else you wouldn't be doing it. And you try to get the best out of it as possible. It's like I don't purposely try to offend. Somebody once said to me, it's very odd. I was never, I was never into punk. Movement. I'm not an anarchist or any of that type of stuff. And as somebody said to me, I have a good friend who kind of is into some of that music too, and he used to say to me, I never understood you. I don't understand, because he goes, when you see something like the Bloody Ape is punk. And I said to him, I said, well, it is, I guess in some ways it is. I think now more than ever I do see what you could consider a punk or a rebellious attitude in it. There is something to it. It took me a while to realize it, but for the longest time I was always looking at what I was trying to get across in that movie. And a lot of it has to do with communication. You think if communication was fucked up then when I made it among people, you think computers and stuff would have helped that? No, it made it worse. To me, it's more fucked up than ever now.
We're supposed to make our lives better. Better than what?
Right, exactly. It's true. No, it's completely true. And that's kind of like how I view Bloody Ape as a movie about fucked up communication. And that was what I was in. Experience time. I remember I was working day jobs, and I would talk to you talk to people. You'd say somebody would say something to you, or you'd say something to them, and they would just mangle it. They would just, it was like nobody was paying attention to what the hell the other person was saying. And that's really the way I view the movie. As far as looking at it now from a technical standpoint, how today's audience would view it, it would look even I guess more punkish or more anachronistic or whatever now, because it's got that because of how crude it is, and it totally kicks the idea of style in the face. I got a little tired of style. I have friends that kept using that word, style, Argento, style, Argento. I'm not against Argento, but I mean it was getting a little bit tiresome to keep hearing style. Oh, we have to be stylish this, we have to be stylish that. I mean, no, just go make a movie, make a good movie.
Use your own style. Why, excuse my French, ape somebody else's style,
Exactly. Create your own. Or, you know what?
Hold on, hold on just a minute, guys. Hold on, I got to say something here. I'm not trying to interrupt, but, you know, as the producer, I just heard Pete say, excuse me. And Pete, since when do you ever say, excuse your French on your own show? Since when do you ever care what you say on this show? All you said was ape. You built it up and then you said ape. Hold on a minute here. I thought you were really going to throw something out there. I thought it was really going to be...
I can do that later. We still got time.
I thought it was going to blow my eardrum out, or I was going to have some meltdowns or something.
Oh, you want me to blow your eardrum? Me and Keith were talking the other night about... because, you know, we both started out, you know, doing conventions when conventions were cool and shit. But then one thing that did morph completely out of control, and I don't know if we ever even addressed this on this show, was the autograph prices and how disrespectful that got.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, I'm gonna hop in here and I'm gonna say, you know, me and Pete were talking about this and we actually stopped ourselves and said, you know, we gotta save this for the show. And it's the autograph crisis is vile. It's such an insult to the fan. And what has happened? And I think me and Pete tried back and we said it must have started with that asshole Achilla, and what he did, what the concept was, is I'm not going to pay a celebrity to come in, but they can charge whatever they want for an autograph. You would bring in some of these jackasses who would take advantage of it and say, see, let me see how far a fan will go to sign something. Say, I have no problem if a celebrity comes in. They bring their own stills, they have black and whites, they have colors. Say they want to charge, in today's prices, they want to charge 10 for a black and white and 20 for a color, and they'll sign, okay, it's something they're selling, they could do that. What's gone berserk is you walking up to them with something that belongs to you and them charging you to sign it. That's going to be $20. It's so insulting. It's so disgusting that it makes you hate the celebrity. For me, anyway, I would turn around and say, you know, you're out of your friggin' mind. I mean, why would you do that to me? That's so insulting. I'm friendly with the producer, Richard Gordon, who's still in New York City. We've had a talk. Last time I saw him, we were talking about this whole thing with the autographs, and he ran afoul of Ben Chapman at one of the conventions because he was signing for free. He was selling, you know, old lobby cards and stuff he had, but he was signing stuff for free, and Chapman was getting furious and said something to him, "You're making me look bad." And you know, the whole concept of an autograph is it's such an honor to be asked for your autograph. This is the way it used to be. That, you know, you should swell with pride and actually be humbled.
Amen.
By somebody asking for that. The fact that somebody could turn around to you and say $20 is a crime. And they're doing it. These guys that you would like to like are doing that now. They come in and they charge you for signing your own thing.
I agree with
your
you about that, yeah. That's
it's
true.
Crazy.
And you know, the thing was with, like, when we're at Cinema Wasteland, now I understand when you got someone out there and they got like five different photos and they, you know, those things are not cheap. Try to get some, I mean, for headshots, those things are expensive as hell. But
yes, they are.
Right. Like with Carolyn Monroe, you know, I went over and I picked up a photo from her, and I had found a CD of the Star Crash soundtrack, which is pretty damn phenomenal. And I had that there too. She signed that for nothing. She's like, give me that. And she ripped it open and signed it for me. And I was like, wow, that's the way it should be. You should
that
be able to do that.
Exactly. They should be, you know, if you come up to them with something of your own, they should. And so many have. I got hit. I'll tell you the truth. What sets my rage off is I got hit once. This was recently. Rob and I had done a Fangoria show. And after the show was kind of over, I went over to a few people. I had a few things that were mine. And they graciously signed it. But one particular person pulled a fast one on me, signed my thing, and before handing it back to me said, that'll be $20. And, you know, this was disgusting.
You can say who it is. It's Freeform Radio.
Oh, you know, all right. Well, let's get into it. It was at the last house on the left table. It wasn't Hess. It wasn't Fred Lincoln. It was the other one. What's his name? Mark Scheffler.
He's supposed to be a dick.
And of all people to do that. You see, and so insulted was I. The whole thing caught me so off guard, and it was embarrassing, and I thought to myself, I said, oh, this is really horrible, and I knew I would get into a war with him if I had said to him, no, I won't, what do you mean by that? How could you do that or anything like that? I gave him the $20 with my teeth clenched, and I thought to myself, I said, you scumbag, and as I'm walking away, he goes, oh, David will be back in a minute, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, fuck that. I'm going to hit him another 20. No, you know what? I like David Hess. I don't want to have to dislike him. I don't like you now. You really pissed me the fuck off. You're disgusting. That was a disgusting thing to do, to take that, sign it, and then tell me $20. It was my press book. It was a press book of Last House on the Left. I didn't make it, but, you know, it was mine. When a man does something like that, you can do nothing but hate him. I mean, that leaves you with a foul taste in your mouth, and I really like the old Last House to the Left, but I'll be goddamn, you know, $20 to have this guy write Ribbon on my fucking press box? Are you kidding me?
Well, you know what it is, too? You know what it really is, too? And a lot of fans aren't aware of this because they think a lot of these people come there out of the goodness of their hearts because they like the fans.
Right.
Now, the whole deal is, I'll give you Robert Englund, for example. He charges upwards of $30,000 an appearance. Yeah. And he charges $35 an autograph. And that goes back to the promoter for the guarantee that he got. Right. Bruce Campbell. $10,000. George Romero, $10,000. The trouble with Romero, though, he's being worked by a guy. Romero's genuinely a good guy. Right. He just got roped in with this guy.
Oh, I agree with you on that. Yeah, oh, I agree with you on that. He is a good guy. The other two guys, no, I think they're just getting what they can, especially considering that they might be thinking that their careers are not going to go any further or whatever. The point is you're exploiting the fan. And the other thing I brought up, Todd, I was telling Pete the other day, and the thing that I brought up is it kills us independent filmmakers because, you know, Todd, if we go there to sell our product and then these kids no longer, or people no longer have the money to buy a new product, they come up to your table and they ask you your price, and we always bring the price, but Rob and I always bring the price down $5 down from whatever it was selling on the internet, and it's still not enough for them. You see them wondering, you see them thinking, or they walk away and it's like, I can get it cheaper on the internet. I guess you can, but you know what? You know, the fact that it's damaging, and what's going to happen is people like me and independent filmmakers like me, we're never going to go to a convention again at this point, because you can't sell, you can't move. And if these people are really going for the big stars and stuff, well, they're sucking all the money up. And some of them might need it, but some of them don't. Yeah. And that's what's even more insulting. So it's like, you know, you're here, you're sucking it up, you're making the situation more miserable for me. Now I'm not going to be here again because I'm very conservative. I've said to Rob, I said, I'm not going to do something like this again because, you know, it's damaging. You can't sell enough. I mean, you make your table back, fine, whatever, but still, that's not enough.
We were saying the other day that the vendors used to be the backbone of the shows. Now what's happening is, especially, you know, the one you mentioned before, Chiller, from what I understand, they're selling the tables to the managers of these stars and just bringing the stars in mercenary and thing. And the whole thing started when I think somebody told me that Ernest Borgnine went back to Hollywood because he did, like, retarded money, like, I don't know, high thousands, 60,000 just for shits and giggles. That's what I had heard. And that's why they all want to come out here, because they know these kids are marks and they'll pay it. But it kills the vendors. And you got the other one down in South Jersey who pays ridiculous guarantees to get these big names down there that, you know, half the time nobody gives a shit. But, you know, everybody's down there for a $35 autograph and $15 or $20 to get in. They got no money left for the vendors' rooms. And the vendors' rooms are full of bootlegs because, you know, guys like you and me that sell legitimate stuff, we can't compete. So, you know, what the fuck? I don't even want to do conventions anymore. That's why I love Wasteland. Wasteland's just a great experience. There's none of this. There's no bootleg crap out there. There's no big fucking egos. It's just a nicely run, very well done show. And everybody agrees with that.
Well, you know what it is? It's like, you know, certainly, you know, it's so damaging. And it's especially damaging to an independent filmmaker or somebody who's trying to put, you know, you can't turn these people on. They want to come for this old star. And like I said, Peter, this was backed up to me because one of the classes I taught, I had some younger people in it. I usually have older adults, but I had some younger people in it. We started talking about conventions, and this one girl had admitted to me. She said, yeah, I spent $75 to spend, 15 minutes with Robert Englund. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, you know, that's it. But you're not having a new experience. You're not.
It's like having a lap dance.
Exactly. Exactly.
What in the hell?
it's crazy, man. I'm telling you right now. You know, I mean, it really pisses you off.
Yeah.
It really, really does. You know, for $75, man, this guy better be going to work on you.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding around. You know. Jeez, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's just gotten crazy out of the air. Like I said, it's just degrading. It's just it's breaking apart. But you know, it's got to crash and burn somewhere. It's going to crash and burn. In the
case of Robert Englund, somebody, his manager, is trying to shop him around to the smaller promotions for $35,000. It's like there's only one guy who's going to pay that. It's the guy in South Jersey, and then the one I think somebody in Florida did it. And it's like, you know, the killer part is, Yeah, he goes there a lot because that's the only place anybody can afford him. You know, and right. Like I say, you know, the ridiculous prices that some of these people are getting, and they got the fans bullshitting, all these, they love their fans, they're coming out. Yeah, for every Sid Haig, which genuinely loves his fans, genuinely appreciates his fans, same with Dave Friedman, Bill Moseley, there's a laundry list of really great people out there, but for every one of them, there's some mercenary, blood-sucking scumbag that's just out there to, you know, rake it all in. And you know something? I said this before. If we didn't see their movies, watch their shows and do their buy their tie and shit, where would they be? Nowhere. Right. So this is how they pay us back, by sticking it in our ass, you know?
Yeah, by sticking exactly. You know, we're victimized. We are literally victimized by the things we love. And it pays to not be a fanatic like that, to allow yourself to be degraded like that by having them take your money like that senselessly. I mean, you know, it's not right. It's definitely, it shows disdain. You can actually see disdain in their faces. Some of these people actually do. You can almost see, like, they can't believe that you'd be stupid enough to give them $20 for an autograph. They look at you like, you know, you're an effing moron. Yeah. And you are. Because it's not right. It's not fair. There was a sense of honor in autographs. And now that that's been defiled, you know, where does it go? Yes, they're going to argue. Some of them are going to say, well, people take that stuff and they sell it on eBay. Some do. Most don't.
Yeah, some do. But, you know, you have to ask yourself this. Linda Blair signs X amount of autographs a show at like 25 a pop. That's, it's like, I know, in fact, she did like $25,000 at a chiller.
Right.
So here's, I don't know, a couple thousand of these autographs floating around. Are they worth anything on eBay if she does X amount of shows, you know?
Right.
You should get a hand stamp made. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk.
You're right, Pete. You're right, and if she's doing that many shows, and if she is that accessible, it is going to run down. It's going to drive down the value of someone selling that on eBay. So where the hell is that going to go? He's going to have to wait a long time to move it, like when she drops dead or something. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
You know, it's just a shame. Like I said, it's the state of fandom, and it's a shame. It really is. It really is. Because you remember better days, and it makes it tough when you think back on it.
I remember, like, when being a horror fan was, you were an outcast. I enjoyed that. Now it's
It was great. Well, that's the problem of the masses, Pete. You know what it is? It's the individual matters. It's the masses that are stupid. Me, and, you know, and I'm not kidding about that. I mean, it's that mass mentality, you know. You get that with these hipsters, and you get it with these people who think we all think alike. No, we don't think alike. You know, I don't agree with so many things that these kids think are right, or whatever they learned in college from their idiot professors, and they spit it out of their mouth. You know, for me, it was always about standing up and being an individual. Back then, you were kind of condemned for liking horror. I remember having problems in elementary school. I brought in a mock guillotine.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, I'm not kidding. You used to cut off. I used to
It was Aurora,
with these clay, you know, with literally the Play-Doh dolls, and you cut the head off. and I got in a lot of trouble. They made my mother come down to the school. They wouldn't give it back to me until she came. It was like, oh, who's this psychotic? He's dangerous. No, you know, taking the toy away from me, though, that could make me dangerous. Maybe I will start to capitalize.
Yeah, you better leave it alone, right?
If you don't let me have my fantasies, it's like there's a reason I'm into this stuff, and it's therapy for me. This is what...
Yeah, here's the best one. I see this disclaimer on these like the two conventions we were talking about, about how violent and pornographic images are not permitted. And I see the violent. Okay, I understand a pornographic. This is a family show, a show you would be proud to take your husband, wife, or girlfriend to. Since when did horror get tame? No violent images. Horror has been blood and guts under the fingernails, veins in the teeth, shit since the get-go. Now you're going to try to make this. It's very bad enough. It's PG rated now. You know.
Oh, it is.
Before we have to go, we should get Keith's information, because we're getting pretty close to the top of the hour.
Okay.
Okay. Wow, man, the time is flying.
We got to bring you back, man. Got to bring
you
back.
I'll tell you, because we're having such a good time here. Yeah. I will say this. Pete, is you and Todd probably know we're going to be at Severed Cinema, is showing The Bloody Ape alongside the film that inspired it, The Night of the Demon, the Bigfoot.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be a double feature. It's January 29th at 7 p.m., and the Severed Cinema is doing, we're really very, very excited about that. And the theater that they're showing it at, which is the Sherman Theater, that's at 624 Main Street. That's in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, 18360. And the phone number is 570-420 2808. And, you know, if you want to get involved, if anyone wants to come out and check us out, I will be there speaking on the film. Pending, of course, we're not hit with some major snowstorm, at least me and Rob trapped here in New York. But other than that, we intend to be there, and I will be.
Yeah, I'm probably going to go up, too. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And I will be talking on the Bloody Ape. You know, it's fairly close, not that far from New York. And I will be talking on the Bloody Ape. It's going to be a pleasure to show it. If people are interested in Blitzkrieg and Bloody Ape, they can get it from WildEyeReleasing.com. And if anyone wants to directly speak with me, you are interested in any of the old stuff I sell or whatever, I'm at Cinefear.com, which is Cinefear, and that's Cinefear.com. And you can directly get at me with emails. And, you know, I really do love the people, and I love what I'm doing. I love the genre and stuff. It is good, though, to be able to get on a show like this tonight and air out some things that have been bothering me, though, because I really don't get a chance to do that. And I think Pete gave me the opportunity to do that, and I feel better about it.
Well, heck yeah, and you're welcome to come anytime. Pete, it's wrap-up time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all we got. Keith, thanks for being on. Really appreciate it. Great stuff. We're definitely going to have you back. And I don't know what we're going to do next week, but I'm sure I'll surprise you. So this is 42nd Street Pete for Jackalope105.com at the Grindhouse saying stay sick and see you next week.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse is a production of Jackalope 105 FM.
Do you feel that? Oh, shit. Wah-ah-ah-ah. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up. Come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me. I can see inside you the sickness is rising. It seems that all that was good has died. Oh no, the world is a scary place. Now that you've woken up the demon in me.
Bobby, will you give it to me?
2, 3, 4.
Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Why can't you just fuck up and die? Get down with the sickness. Fuck you, I don't need this shit. I'm down with the sickness. You stupid, sadistic, abusive fucking organ. Down with the sickness. Here it comes. Get ready to die. Get ready to die.
Here we go again, motherfucker, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on down and see the idiot right here. Too fucked to beg and not afraid to care. What's the matter with calamity anyway? Right, get the fuck out of my face. Understand I can't feel anything. It isn't like I want to sift through the decay. I feel like a wound, like I got a fucking gun against my head. You live when I'm dead. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. Come on. Me now, so fuck it. Blood on my face and my hands, I don't know why. I'm not afraid to cry, but that is none of your business. Overdo it, don't tell me you blew it. Stop your bitching and fight your way through it. I'm not like you, I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker, everybody has to die. People equal shit.